Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Hello, good morning and welcome. Yes, you're in Camino with me, Kit Hogg, live on Talk Radio Europe this Saturday, the 20th of June. Can you believe it's the 10th anniversary of Brexit? I wonder if you can remember where you were when you heard the referendum result. Well, following Pedro Sanchez's offer of amnesty to residents requiring residency post-Brexit, we speak to one patient applicant having been embroiled in what seems to be an interminable process, now becalmed with no news of her application in what seems to be an interminable wait. I'll be trying to get hold of Coibs, who's driving towards the Pyrenees this morning. Last week, he was one of two Spanish delegates at the Women's World Rugby Conference. Stand by for an insight into the sharp end complexity of the science and psychology of elite sport. And subsequent to our visit to the Mosque of Cordoba last week, we look at the regime, if indeed one can call it a regime, that precedes the Caliphate of Al-Andalus. Together with Giles Brown, let's plunge into the Dark Ages and say hello to the Visigoths.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Even those of us with a rudimentary grasp of Spanish history are aware that the Romans, they were here for a long time ago, and after them came the Moors, Islamic invaders from over the water in North Africa, and they, like the Romans before them, they stayed for a while too. Both Romans and Moors profoundly affected the Iberian Peninsula politically, culturally, linguistically. Rome ruled Hispania from 2018 BC to AD 409, 6 centuries during this period. Spain enjoyed real political and cultural unity, the advent of Christianity, an advanced legal system, a language that forms the basis of Castellano, Gallego, Catalan, Valenciano today, plus architectural and engineering principles that still stand today. The awesome Viaduct of Segovia, for example, you may have seen it. Mérida's amphitheatre. As for the Moors, well, only last week on this program, we sampled one of the jewels of their heritage, the Mosque of Cordoba, the spiritual hub of a caliphate that dominated Islamic Spain. The Moors arrived in 711, their last political vestige extinguished by Ferdinand and Isabella in 1492. And like the Romans before them, they held hegemony here for 6 centuries. But what happened in the 300 years between the end of the Romans and the arrival of the Moors, the so-called Dark Ages of early medieval Europe? Did the lights really go out with the arrival of an initially frightening but ultimately weird race of people known to us as the Visigoths? Who were they? What is their legacy? Indeed, do they even have one? Or did they just fill a vacuum between two great civilizations? In consideration of the question, just how dark are the Dark Ages of 5th, 6th and 7th century Spain, we're blessed by the company of local historian Giles Brown. Giles.
Unlikely historian. I think of all the things. Morning to you, Kit.
Morning, mate.
Now, you see, the thing is, as for those who are listening on a regular basis will know, that surprisingly enough, there are two things that get my goat going. And obviously, history is one of them, okay? And also sort of dark rock music is the other. So this is the perfect storm, because I very rarely take issue with the wit, wisdom, and indeed, deep thought of Ian Anderson and Jethro Tull. However, The Dark Ages is a brilliant song by The Tull. However, it is completely wrong. We are not talking Dark Ages. We are talking a fascinating kaleidoscope that intersects, it combines, it crashes against each other. It involves the whole way that you look at European history, where you base, throw away your Western European thoughts of where civilization begins, because, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls and whatever that is lurking in the corner wearing brocaded gold, I am taking you on a 10-minute tour of one of the most fascinating periods of a fascinating country, and that is Spain and the Visigoths.
Wicked, man, wicked. Listen, before we talk about what they did or didn't do,
yep.
Who were they?
Who were they?
Where did they originate?
Yep.
And how did they get here?
Okay, so get your tribal dictionaries ready, because we're going on a whistle-stop raid. So we'll do it as a Q&A for you, okay? So we're talking Dark Ages, right? So let me set the scene. It is about 400 and something we're talking AD, okay? The Roman Empire, based around Rome, is falling apart rapidly, okay? Germania, the tribes, are on the border of the Rhine. Now, nothing exists in a vacuum, and meanwhile, over on the steeps, on the eastern steeps, i.e. what we call Russia now, there's a rumbling. There are dust clouds on the horizon, because who's coming? It's the Huns, ladies and gentlemen, everybody's favourite villain. Short composite bows, vicious horsemen, and they put the living fear of Attila to every man, woman, and child. Incredibly vicious, because they don't understand the concept of serfdom, because they are, if you like, nomadic tribespeople. They don't do agriculture. So when they come across a bunch of people working, tilling the fields, like the Goths, and the Franks are doing, they think, well, that's no use. What are they doing on the planet? And promptly mainly slaughter them.
So they don't grow potatoes, these people?
Not big on potatoes, no.
They hunt. They're meat eaters.
Yak mainly. You can't go far without, you can't go wrong with a yak, is the basic. So basically, nomadic, very, very organized, yeah? Let's not go complete Game of Thrones and think, you know, what's it, Jason Momoa and the Khaleesi and all that, but pretty damn close. They've got a very interesting, they've got a brilliant structure for getting the message around, because it's a massive empire, always on the move, right, all the way from basically what we call Mongolia now to pushing Hungary.
Well, we're way before Genghis Khan, aren't we?
We are not way before Genghis Khan. This is the thing, this is Attila. So this is the same, roughly, we're in that sort of 100 to 200 years time period. Tamburlaine is the one you're looking for. Anyway, let's get off that, because we're going to talk about the Visigoths.
Yes.
So they push, right? And the Franks and the Goths go, what got in Himmel? Was ist das? Fdunk. And so they've got to get out of town. And the great thing they've got is the Rhine, because that is a, it's not... It's,
Hang on, Charles. Yeah. Listen, we've spoken about Goths, we've spoken about Huns, we've spoken about Franks.
Right. Let's Germanic tribes, right? Huns... From what you now call Mongolia, i.e. or Crimea or Ukraine, okay? So Slavic peoples, okay?
Okay.
Fast-moving ponies.
Yep.
Right? Germanic tribes, battle axes, yeah?
Forest dwellers.
Forest dwellers, battle axes, can't defeat, they're not ready for the attack of the Huns. They have to get out. The pressure is incredible, yeah? So all these tribes, Goths are Germanic, Franks are Western Germanic, right? They get pushed against the Rhine. The Roman Empire.
There's a pressure coming from the east, basically. There's
massive
pushing people
pressure
westwards.
People think this is the end of the world, Kit. Mm-hmm. People think these are the devil's horsemen.
Mm-hmm.
They've never seen anything like that. They don't play by the normal rules of tribal warfare. They slaughter everybody. You pay tribute, or you get done, basically. And not in a nice civilized, and we're talking civilized in italics here, not in a civilized sort of in the Teutoburg forest kind of way. Total, you know, your women are children are slaves, your men, spikes everywhere, basically. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly. People pay a fortune for that sort of treatment.
Not a good scenario.
Yeah. Anyway, so basically, something's got to give, right? At the same time, the Roman Empire, the Western Roman Empire, i.e., what we think of now, you know, Romans. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very decadent. It's the empire now. It can't support. It's having problems supporting. They decide to let the Germans in. Because it's basically people, you know, Germanic tribes crossing the Rhine in small boats situation.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
A human tide.
This is not Brexitus Maximus that we voted for.
They couldn't withstand.
They couldn't. Yeah. So they let the Germanic Germanics in, right? So the Franks and the Goths in, right? One bunch of them go east. Those are the Ostrogoths. Mm-hmm. Yeah, one bunch goes south. These are the Visigoths. But also at the same time, the Franks, who basically come from sort of Burgundy region, Belgium, Low Countries, yeah?
Yeah.
Well known for their large moustaches and their very tight trousers. They become the Merovingian kings. If you know your... I haven't even got to Spain yet. Here we go. If you know your awful Dan Clark's, you know, the Da Vinci whatever, he's the one who thinks that they are Jesus, Jesus and Mary Magdalene had a kid, and it's those are the Merovingian kings. The Merovingians were a bit like Saxon fans, are you, the band? Long hair, moustaches, very tight trousers. But somewhat like you wear on stage, Kit. Yeah? That's saying therefore. Anyway...
I base myself on a Marine.
Exactly. Yeah. So basically what happens is the Franks, yeah, and the Goths are always fighting each other. Just because we're fleeing from fleeing from Millwall fans don't mean that we won't have a fight between, you know, West Ham and Chelsea. So basically, that's tribal for you. Basically, the Franks and the Goths, Ostrogoths go east, Hungary, that sort of area, right? Mm. And also Lombardy, which is North Italy. Roman Empire is now imploding. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can't hack it. Eastern Roman Empire becomes the Byzantine Empire. That'll come in later. Oh, we're going to have to do a two-parter on this. That'll come in later.
I think so.
Right, okay. So, Franks, tight trousers, big moustaches, long hair, right? Think, so the Franks and the Huns are now stuck at the Rhine. They can't go any further. There's a massive battle just outside Hungary. The Attila and his lot can't go any further. So that's the end of the Huns, the devil's horsemen. They can't get into Europe, thank goodness. They're stopped. So they go back and decide to have a crack at the Chinese, hence the Great Wall. Okay.
Okay.
Right, you know, honestly, that's quite
a long way to go back.
It's a massive empire,
right,
on a scale that we're only just discovering, yeah?
Yep.
They're fascinating. Meanwhile, Franks, and you may have heard of Charlemagne, that sort of thing, you know, the French.
Definitely.
Yeah, well, his predecessors, they're the Franks, and they are always having dust-ups with the Goths, okay? The Visigoths kind of have from Gascony, which is, if you like, you know, it's good rugby.
Southwest France.
Southwest France, Aquitaine. So they dust up, they have a mass. But basically, Visigoths get forced to the Pyrenees. So they are now basically running. So they go over the Pyrenees and thought, right, we'll take Spain. Okay. In the meantime, Spain, still Roman. You've got Roman Spanish.
Yes.
So let's not think of Spain as a kingdom. Basically, Spain is now a series of noble lands. Still think that they're Romans, basically. Okay.
Yes, you would call them Hispano-Romans.
Hispano-Romans.
I mean, the Romans have been here for a long, long time.
Yeah,
yes.
And the system is working. And Theoric, well, the first Visigoth king of Spain is a guy called Ulrich, okay? He's the one who takes most of Spain, apart from a few sort of Basque regions and Asturias.
Right, so where the Visigoths didn't encounter a whole lot of resistance.
No, because...
The Roman armies had left.
Yeah, and it's basically, you're talking city-states.
Right.
Okay, so, for example, Tarragona, and down here as well, because Andalusia's got an awful... Medina Sidonia, Tarifa, you know, Bayoca, they're all big Roman provinces on the road, up past Malacca, i.e. Malaga, up to Murcia, Almeria, all the big staging posts on the road to Rome. So they're still, if you like, run by mini-governors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and these are pretty... I mean, there's a talk that Ulrich marries a Spanish noblewoman, good move. She's got 2,000 Christian slaves under her belt. So we're talking some pretty good land. And they are always highlighting their relationship with Rome, because Rome, they also become Catholic at this point as well. The Romans are no longer worshipping Mars and various gods. They're Catholics. Okay?
Yeah, yes.
Right. Now the problem with that is, yeah, our friends the Visigoths, they're Arians. Now, it doesn't mean that they're singing the horse vessel song and doing strange, silly walks like John Cleese. Arianism, okay, and before you all start getting offended, Arianism is a schism that is basically, you believe that God created Jesus, right? Catholic Church, the Holy Trinity, they're all in one, yeah? So for the Catholic Church, the Visigoths are heretics. This will come important later because obviously Pope... And the Patriarch of Constantinople, Byzantine again, yeah, they're saying the Visigoths are heretics, right? So there's that whole situation now where the Visigoths...
Right, and are the Visigoths at all Christian?
They're Christian, but they believe that God created Jesus.
Is that not unreasonable?
No, because the Trinity says that this, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, they're all one.
Okay.
So that's
okay.
We are dancing on the head of...
It's a minor point of difference.
Well, yeah, but we're not... But again, Kit, we are not in the 4th century. I know we've got the hairstyles and the beards to go with it, but we're not in the 4th century, and this matters. By the way, Dark Ages, because we're looking at... So we've got Romans. So we've got, you know, the Roman Empire... It's disintegrating. Rome has been sacked, but it doesn't matter because they, you know, the Roman Empire has basically gone become the Eastern Empire, and they're all based in Constantinople.
Constantinople, yeah.
The Byzantine Empire, right?
Yeah.
Now, in the meantime, right, so that's all going off. The Franks are getting defeated, getting pushed back by Theodoric, who's now married the Spanish noblewoman.
Theodoric the Visigoth.
Yes, Theodoric.
Who is now based in Spain.
He's now based in Spain.
Right.
In Toledo.
Because yes, Toledo became their capital.
Exactly.
I think their capital was initially Medina, but then they moved to Toledo.
Exactly.
They moved to Toledo, yeah.
Anyway, I mean, I'm going to have to cut this down, or you'll be here for the rest of the day.
You've got another 7 minutes.
Really?
Charles.
Oh, fantastic.
We have another. No, it's fantastic.
Okay, so.
Listen, degenerate German expatriates who never really understood nor integrated with Spain, and whom the Spanish didn't take to either. Is that a fair summation of the Visigoths? There were only about 200,000 of them.
Yeah, but
had long blonde flaxen hair. Did they integrate?
Yes.
They
integrated.
Did they?
Yes, they intermarried. Also, let's not forget the big Jewish population in Spain.
Yes.
At this time, you know, don't forget that as well. They're integrated, so they're married. They're having political marriages. Okay, and this kind of comes up because basically. The major flaw in the Visigoth system is that your son does not, if I'm the Visigoth king, your son does not automatically inherit.
It was elective, wasn't it?
Elective, right?
Yeah.
And the other thing the Goths do, yeah, apart from play too much Bauhaus and wear dark clothing, is the fact that they tend to parcel up land between the, so if you, Kit, are my son and you have, you know, and you've got Kitteric and Catteric, my sons, I will give you each, you know, a third of my kingdom, which is great in my own Trotskyist principles. But what tends to happen in real life is that the sons don't get on, and the next thing you know, you've got massive civil wars, okay? In the meantime, Theodoric decides to become a Catholic because he's marrying the Catholic high-ranking noble Roman Spanish woman. So he converts to Catholicism. However, there's always the women in this, and so we're thinking Game of Thrones, Cersei. She is a straight-out Aryan. Doesn't mean that she likes Unity Mitford, but it means that she believes that Jesus is created by God and not the three. That is the nobles, in the meantime, show, you know how the British nobility doff to the king, etc.
Yes.
The Visigoth nobility are a bunch of scrabbling so-and-sos. They are not united behind the king. They are always looking up. They're more concerned.
Is that about being an elective monarchy, though?
Because
you've not got a dynasty. You've got a bunch of competing nobles who might become elected to be
exactly.
The next king.
Exactly. So they're always looking after the
Let's just talk about the kings for a moment, Charlie, because out of 34 Visigoth kings,
I know,
only 15 died of natural causes.
That's
a high rate of regicide.
Average life expectancy between 18 months, 2.5 years.
Chaos. Let's talk about their names. I've got Witteric, Womba, and Witisa. Who have you got?
Oh, well, we've got Theoric, Ulrich, and of course the last one, of course, who's Roderick, who is one of my favourites. Can I just also put a special shout in, because Byzantines, my favourite passion, they're coming around from Constantinople.
Yes.
They've gone in... Look at Europe from a Mediterranean perspective, okay? North Africa is part of Europe at this point, right? Byzantine has gone through like a dose assault, got rid of the Vandals. Again, we're not talking West Ham fans. The Vandals were a race who also fled, literally, from across the Rhine, as did the... there was a tribe called the Alans. Yeah, we never know what happened to the Alans.
No,
but what a great! But it's not fearsome. Is it the Vandals? It's the guy that says, "Hello, I'm the Alans. I'm from accounts."
I'm an Andrew.
So anyway, the Byzantines come belting through what is now Libya, right, and completely destroy the Vandals by Vandals. Yeah, take Ceuta.
Yeah,
yeah, and also go across, and they basically have from the Algarve, up to Tarifa, Algeciras is Byzantine territory. So there is massive ruction. And the Byzantines are brilliant. They are colourful. They are fluorescent. They're in purple. They have eunuchs to spare. They got a fearsome army. We're a big fan of Byzantium here.
Did they show up, the Visigoths? I mean, they didn't get on with the Visigoths.
They didn't get on with the Visigoths at all. They were always
welcome.
Because Patriarch of it's the Eastern Roman Empire. So they're Catholic, the whole thing. So massive battles. Basically, comes to a head. They go from Tarifa West to De Algarve. That's Byzantine. And they get kind of left alone.
I've got the greatest Visigoth king, who is considered to be a guy called Leo Vigild.
Leo Vigild, yes.
Have you heard of Leo Vigild?
I'm going through my guilds here, and I haven't got my glasses on, but what is...
His claim to historical notoriety rests with crushing a Cantabrian religion, a rebellion.
They were always, yeah, again.
Encouraging Visigoths to marry Spaniards. And in rabid persecution of Christians, he oversaw the martyrdom of his own son, the unfortunate Hemeldegild.
Yeah.
How sad is that, man, to be martyred by your own father?
Yeah, but this, I mean, honestly, this, it makes Game of Thrones look like Jack and Nori.
Does it ever, yeah.
You know, I mean, there's Gunhild as well, and she has a run-in with you, because basically also, the Visigoths at one point have to call in their mates, their family, the Ostrogoths, to come over and sort it out. So Theoric, right, he comes over and he cracks heads, including against, because the Franks come over the border again, all tight trousers and BG-type lyrics, and so he basically has to go back, come over from Lombardy, i.e. North Italy, where he's ruling, sail over, land, because there's been another regicide. There's like a three-month-old. He rules for 15 years, this Theoric, and he basically kind of stabilises the Visigoth Empire, cracks heads with Franks once again, but again, he dies of natural causes, which is quite unknown. So,
what is their heritage, though?
What they left?
What did they leave?
You see, because they...
Apart from a very entertaining 20 minutes on
great,
CRE,
yeah, great,
this Saturday morning,
right,
the 20th
okay,
of June.
Just,
know, can we visit a Visigoth ruin, for example?
Well, there are a couple, but again, like always, they get built on, yeah? But beautiful, I mean, there are the remains of Visigoth sort of temples in Toledo. You have to look for it, and I'll come back onto that in a little, because again, a lot of it gets destroyed, but there are beautiful sort of, there's still a couple of there's a Visigoth actually up like in your neck of the woods, there's a Visigoth church, believe it or not, but you see
in my neck of the woods,
yeah, up in Galthine Caceres.
Oh really?
Yeah,
right,
because
okay.
it's a major route, Kit. You know, this is amazing.
Okay,
I mean there's a huge, okay, so.
But Charles, we're not talking about the Segovia Viaduct.
No,
I mean, Medida, amphitheatre.
They
weren't great builders.
Because they haven't got a king, because they're decentralised. There's no such thing as a centralised. It's not like a monarchy, it's not like a caliphate.
They did have a capital. They're based in Toledo.
They have a capital, but that makes it's easier to find the king and murder him. But they also, a lot of them, in time, they come down to Seville. Seville is a major Visigoth centre as well, and there is just quickly 7-Eleven, apart from being a convenience store, is also there are various rumours, but basically there's another round of regicide, and one bunch of a murdered king's sons, they get a dodge and they flee across to Ceuta, right, which is still under Byzantine, my friends from Constantinople, it's under their rule, okay, and they are allowed to stay there, this family. So Roderick is elected king in 709. Okay, this is the end game. All right.
Yeah.
So he gets elected. He takes a wife, quote unquote, which is the daughter of one of the counts who's fled across to stay with the Byzantines,
yes,
North Africa.
Yes.
Now the rumor is that he's raped the woman, and so therefore the
on a riverbank,
yeah. But yeah. Again, this is being written by celibate Christian Catholics a hundred years later. So hey, okay, they're never going to be fans of the Visigoths. But long story short. They get the permission, the dynasties have come down. The first expedition of Tarik is they don't come over and go surprise. They do like reconnoitering. So the first one goes to lands in near Bologna.
Talking about the advent of the Moors.
Come through because the Byzantines have let them come through because they know that hey, Islam is coming. So Tarik goes to test the water. On behalf of the caliphate, lands in Tarifa, 709, small battle, comes back, goes, I'm not going over there, boss. 710, goes around to just to Beled Malaga, lands there. Goes, well, I don't like the road network, so back again. So 711 is the big one, hits Gibraltar, takes it over with the Berber.
Yes.
Yeah, right. That's the big one.
Yeah.
Roderick is in the north at the point. He's fighting against the Franks. Surprise, surprise. They've come again. Tight trousers, long hair, BG lyrics.
Damn Franks.
Damn Franks. He's got to get back. There's no Ave at this point, right?
No,
so
no.
He's got to bring his army, right, from the Pyrenees, right, all the way through to... basically between, and here we go, they have a major battle. The big battle is just outside between Tarifa and it's between Becher and Medina Sidonia, right? Mm-hmm. Big battle. Now, defeated because, guess what? The Visigoths and the Bilitid go, nah, we'll stay with him. Because we'll stay with this guy. Tarik seems quite reasonable. He's going to give me my land. Sorry, Roderick. I'm now becoming, I'm going to fight for the Caliphate.
Right, okay. So they were split. The Visigoths were split.
Yeah, basically. Like, you know basically. That scene in Braveheart where they turn
tail?
Yeah. Roderick retreats. He gets all the way back to Seville. There's a big battle in 713. And then he is slain, right? And the Visigoths, basically, the empire of the Visigoths, if you like, falls apart at that point. Lots of them flee north. And that is the end of the Visigoth Empire.
And the Moors make incredible progress.
Because...
Justin, we're going to have to talk about this another time.
I know.
Coy be waiting.
I know.
He's on the road in Catalonia.
Right.
He's going to be talking to us about sports
science. There's a Visigoth army coming the other way. But basically, it's not an invasion. Loads of the people go, you know what? The Moors aren't quite bad. The Jews go, fine, we can still trade. And that is the foundation in 20 minutes to Visigoths.
We've got Pompey on the line saying, bloody hell, it's a history of Europe. Yeah, listen, man, it's been wonderful. If you've managed to follow that, then you're doing pretty well. I hope everyone's been taking notes.
Why don't we have kings called Roderick anymore? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, well, we can go on with this story.
I think we should.
Or we could embellish. Certainly, I mean, we've just skated over so much of a fascinating
period. I want to talk about Greece.
Have we shone any light on a dark age?
It's not the dark ages.
Or do you think we just confused people even more?
No, it's not the dark ages, kids. It's not the dark ages.
We need to re-educate ourselves. There's no longer the dark ages. We have blazed a light on what has been...
I'll be back in a month to give you more.
All right, bud. Lovely, lovely to see you, man. Thank you so much. We're going to be with Coy B after the break.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Caminando por la calle en camino. My next guest this morning is Coy Hogg, regular friend of the show, strength and conditioning coach for the Spanish women's rugby team. Coy B, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for coming on. Speaking to you in Barcelona, yeah?
Yeah, in Barcelona currently.
And how is the weather in Barcelona?
The weather is much nicer than in Sevilla, I'll tell you that for free.
Has it got a bit hot in Seville?
Yes, it's got a bit hot in Seville, yeah, about 40 degrees currently.
Right.
So Barcelona is quite breezy in comparison, to be honest. It's very nice.
Yes, it's quite nice here too, on the Costa del Sol, not too hot yet. Now, you were in Richmond, am I right, last week?
Yes, I was in Richmond, England.
Richmond, England, yeah. Cool, green England, at the Women's World Rugby Conference. It sounds like you had some pretty sharp-end lectures going on and discussions with some fairly enlightened people, like coaches like yourself. Can you give us an insight into what went on during those few days?
Yeah, so this is the first time that I've ever been to one of these kind of events, and I didn't really know what to expect. But it's an event that's done yearly, so every year World Rugby will get together with the head coaches and S&C coaches, S&C meaning strength and conditioning, from all of the kind of major women's rugby unions. So we all got together this year. It was Richmond, but apparently previous years it's been in, you know, Sydney, Australia or Dubai. So I'm hoping next year maybe they'll take us somewhere more tropical.
Right.
You never know.
It might be in Spain. You have to stay here.
Yeah, could also be that. But it's a moment where people kind of get together. There's lots of presentations. You get some speakers who come who are like external to World Rugby, or maybe have worked in rugby in a different aspect. And there was lots of information and presentations on current unions and their recent experience of the Women's Rugby World Cup, which was last August. And then there was also, as I say, like external speakers that came from outdoors to kind of help progress the coaching and help just improve the level of rugby. So the way I kind of saw it was that it was World Rugby investing back into the coaching structure, so that the competition keeps improving, the game keeps improving, and you kind of make rugby into a more attractive product.
Yeah, so it was a kind of coaching fest, I'm getting. And you had a range of different lectures, which are all sound pretty intriguing, really. There was one called Culture and Care. There was another called Performance Intelligence and Mental Skills. There was another called Reverse Engineering, Planning with the End in Mind. Pick one of those to talk about, Coibs.
Yeah, so these were given by the three that you mentioned were all given by people external to World Rugby who they bring in to give these chats. And like as you say, it was almost a festival of coaching. It felt like I was living inside a high performance podcast. You know, like I'm not sure if you've ever listened to these shows where they get big people in and they'll talk to, you know, I don't know, Pep Guardiola about his psychology of coaching and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so fascinating stuff.
It was like full immersion into all these kind of concepts that I'd never really been a part of because I'm very, very new on the coaching scene, let alone the international scene. So, for example, one that really stood out for me, and I you could probably relate, especially well today, being the Premiership final for the men's, is a guy called Matt Ferguson, who everyone knows as Fergie. And he used to work at the Northampton Saints and has now just been employed by Harlequins. So he came in to talk about, you know, care and the culture of care, and how he basically outlined the structure of Northampton Saints over the last cycle, where they were kind of ninth in the Premiership, to move up all the way to win it and to reach the final of the Champions Cup. So it was super interesting just hearing the kind of things that they put into place in order to reach those goals, in order to create the club that they've got there at the moment. And what really stood out from him, obviously you can kind of tell by the presentation title, but it's the importance of the human element of it. So no one actually talked about what kind of drills they were doing or tactics or anything like that. Most of the people who were talking were presenting on like the human connection side of sport and how like if you care for your players and you make it clear to your players that you do care for them, then you're going to get a huge amount of performance and benefits in return. That doesn't mean that care is soft. You know, care can be hard as well. So it doesn't mean that you have to be nice and all the time to your players, because I guess it's like if you have a strict parent growing up and you run off down the beach or something like that and you get lost, and by the time you're found again, you get a whack, it's because they care. You know, those kind of things also happen. So that's what really stood out for me, is like the kind of human element of that from Matt Ferguson's presentation. He gave a lot of examples of how they kind of created that. So it was really, really good to see in a world where like where you're studying for high performance, you're kind of studying spreadsheets and numbers and testing protocols. But it was so refreshing to hear people at the top of the game not really pay too much heed to that kind of stuff.
Mm. So you had another lecture from a guy called Andrew May, talking about performance intelligence and mental skills. Give us a sense of that, Coibs.
Yeah, so performance intelligence, it was basically around sports psychology, but also, I mean, it was given by, as you mentioned, this guy Andrew May, who does a lot of corporate speaking. He's worked within Australia rugby. I mean, the guy's an Aussie through and through. He works with the New South Wales Waratahs and within a lot of rugby league, which is obviously huge in Australia. So working with these clubs, what he kind of outlined was that there was like a toolkit, like a mental toolkit that he'd give to not only players, but probably more importantly to coaches. So his message to us as coaches was, you know, before we start giving talks or lectures on mental skills, that the first thing we need to do is learn it ourselves and learn how to use them. And then apply that to psychology and kind of frames of mind that anyone listening would recognize in themselves. So he talked about this, red brain, blue brain, which is a concept which was created by a guy called Gilbert Anoka, who's the All Blacks mental skills coach for a lot of years. So red brain is, for example, when you get a big reaction from the amygdala, like a big amygdala response, which is the part of the brain which goes from fight to flight. So when someone cuts you off in traffic or something happens and all of a sudden you feel like this urge of rage or reaction,
yeah,
you get a big reactive response. That's the amygdala. So how do you move out of that red brain into the blue brain? So it's all like tools of how you can get across that bridge.
So hang on, what's happening in the blue brain?
The blue brain is rational. It can make decisions. It's not like the monkey brain, which is another thing that they said. So if you can imagine like an angry ape in the wild, right. And that's what they use that analogy, because you know, if someone cuts you off in traffic and immediately you jump off and you start swearing at them,
yeah,
or you do a maneuver yourself in your car, that's your monkey brain. And actually, if you were to look at that from afar, you would look like an idiot. So it's more like, is this actually a good decision to make at the time, or do you want to move into your blue brain where you can make a better decision?
But going out, but in the heat of battle and in a game as physical and as emotionally tuned as rugby, surely the monkey brain has its use as well. You need to be able to feel that surge of whatever it is that in a negative way can convert into road rage.
Yeah, I think. I don't think that would come immediately from what they call the red brain. The red brain also is source. I mean, there's two things to it. One of it is the immediate response of anger or aggression, which is definitely important for rugby. So to get some of that response is good, but it's like how you direct that force or how you direct that energy. So if you can create that aggression that you need for rugby specifically within the blue brain, because it's a decision that you make, then it's going to be much more powerful and better directed. And another thing of the red and blue brain that was really interesting is that the red brain is not just that reactive side of things. It's also when you're turning up to a session or you're turning up to a job or a presentation with clients, if you're in the corporate world, would be you're feeling tired, you're feeling a little bit anxious, things are worrying you, and you know, you're kind of in that negative space. So it's like, how do you cross that bridge and get to the blue brain where you need to be, where even if you think you're super tired or you haven't slept well, there's always a way to get there, which is really interesting. So he used an example, which I really enjoyed. So he said, I mean, you, for example, you've bought a car recently, haven't you? Not sure if you've told the listeners.
I have bought a car recently, yes.
You have bought a car recently. What car have you bought?
I bought a Toyota Land Cruiser.
Cool. So when you're driving down the road nowadays, what do you see? What stands out to you?
The noise it makes. It's a V6, and it sounds like a big boat. It's really
right. But
it sounds so nice that sometimes I don't even play any music. I just have the window slightly open so I can hear
But when you're looking at the other cars on the road, which cars stand out to you?
Oh,
well,
you immediately notice other Land Cruisers, don't you? I mean, if you buy a Mini, you start noticing Minis, and you think, God, I never realised there were so many Minis on the road. I mean, exactly. Every time you buy a car, that's yes, go on.
That's going to happen. So is that example is whatever's in your mind is what you're going to be noticing, yeah? So if you're in your red brain and you're thinking of negative things and how tired you are and how anxious you are and how you've got to get through the day and you're not sure how you're going to do it, what you're going to be noticing is all of the kind of negative little triggers or things that are going to make you more negative, because that's your mind frame at the time. Whereas if you can cross that bridge and use some of the techniques that he's talking about to get into the blue brain, then that you'll stop worrying about those negative side of things and you can start training yourself to look at the positive stuff and the constructive stuff. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it definitely makes sense, yes. I wonder where fatigue fits in there, though, because the red brain surely becomes more prevalent the tireder you are.
Yeah, definitely. And he spoke about that as well. So, for example, then there's ways to kind of break it down whereby in a sports setting, imagine you've got a player who's at the beginning of training and is in like a kind of red brain atmosphere. So he's tired, he's grouchy, maybe it's the last session of the week or something like that, or hasn't slept well. So you've got a 90-minute session in front of you. One of the things to kind of get through that fatigue is just to focus on the session in small blocks. So training will be planned accordingly, where you've only got like, you know, you've got 4 minutes where there's 4 minutes of open play. So you're just going to focus for those 4 minutes. After those 4 minutes, when there's a water break, you're going to relax and you're not going to pay any attention to it. And then when you come back to the 4 minutes, you're going to make that effort to be there and present for those times as well.
Yes.
So to try and combat that fatigue.
Sure, yeah. Sure. You're focusing on the baby steps.
So it's like climbing a mountain. You don't look at the top. You look at your next objectives.
Yeah, I said that very thing to somebody yesterday on the telephone who was depressed about her long-term future. And I said, yeah, well, don't look at the summit too much because you might trip up. It's the immediate path you've got to be looking at and focus on, which is all about the journey. Being important and rather than the destination in Camino. Listen, mate, it's been wonderful talking to you. We could go on, but I'm going to have to call it a day there because I've got another aspect of this fascinating show to get to. So Quibs, thanks so much, man. Have a wonderful day. Are you heading up to the mountains later?
We're heading out for a bit of socializing. So not looking at the mountain,
looking at the next immediate. Step. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Fabulous stuff. Thank you so much. That's
All right. Thank you for having me.
Corey Hogg, strength and conditioning coach for the Spanish women's rugby team. Kate Sermon coming up next. Hello and welcome back. Bring Tahini from Bombono down a second. Out of all of the, I wonder if you're aware that it is 10 years since Brexit. And out of all the gamut of British citizenry, few have been impacted by Brexit, like expatriate UK passport holders. And scandalously, even though many of us were living in the EU in 2016, we never got to vote in the referendum. Was it really 10 years ago? And can you remember where you were when you heard the result? I can, as when England won the World Cup in 1966, 60 years ago. I was at a wedding. The tedium of Brexit for us Brits who do live here is manifest every time you fly in and out of the Eurozone. It used to be so easy. Now, long queues at security, fingerprints, facial recognition, stamps on your passport, a whole rigmarole of hassle compared with, say, a flight within the EU to, say, Amsterdam or Warsaw, where getting off the plane at the airport is as unregulated as getting off a bus. The punishing backwash for Brits who do not have TIE residencia is the 90-day visa overstay at your peril. In line with his open-armed approach for immigrants earlier this year, the president, Pedro Sanchez, announced an amnesty. Some 500,000 people living in Spain, unregistered, beyond their welcome, under the radar, visa overstayed, were to be granted residency. Not all amnesty applicants are illegal, of course. Many have complied with the mandatory requirements of comings and goings, the inconvenience of a migratory existence with a foot in two different homes in two different countries. I'm delighted this morning to be joined by Kate Sermon. Kate, hi, how are you doing?
Hi, Kate. Yeah, well, thank you.
You're applying for residency and have been for a while. Tell us, how's it going?
It's dealing with that uncertainty, which is the problem that a lot of us face. I spent my first year in Spain, having now been here a year and a half, on a digital nomad visa, which unfortunately the renewal got rejected despite not changing my circumstances.
Why did it get rejected?
Well, I think a number of reasons, a few reasons, potentially the way in which it was presented and a few sort of niff-naff things that I could change. But the overarching problem is I'm self-employed and do freelance work. Therefore, the work is sporadic, project-based, and I always thought, as long as I can prove that I've got the income requirement coming in, it was okay. And that's how I got my visa issued in the first place. But Spain seemed to want to see a regular salary. So, you know, every month hitting that amount that it needs, you know, the total income they want to see divided by 12. They want to see that every month. So that isn't the understanding I had of it. And I got my visa issued fair and square, so I thought. But anyway, upon rejection of the digital nomad visa, happened to be the first day of the window opening for this amnesty, so I've gone for it. I've applied for it.
Yes, okay. So you made it, that the original nomad visa that you had had a duration of a year, am I right?
A year, with the view that you can then renew for years 2 and 3 and renew again for years 4 and 5. And seeing as my circumstances haven't changed and I'm meeting all the prerequisites, I didn't think I'd face a problem.
Right. Okay. So you don't have any explanation as to why your application for extension was rejected?
Well, an advisor has said to me, because I applied for it initially in England, it's very different to then renewing in Spain. And despite it being called a digital nomad visa, the two countries have got very different sort of
requirements,
criteria, requirements. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, it doesn't say that anywhere. So based on being issued one and paying £1,500 for my visa for myself and my four-year-old.
Oh, no, digo. Wow.
I've sort of got him into school. I'm renting a house. I'm, you know, embedded in Spain now. To then face, my visa has now been rejected. My 90 days have expired. But I do have this application in for the amnesty.
Okay, right. So what's your status now? You're basically pendiente permiso. Have you got a justificante that allows you to travel to and, you know, to travel out of the country, out of the Eurozone, and get back in again on the basis that you've made an application for amnesty?
No. And I don't think it's a strong enough argument to have something of that ilk.
That won't guarantee. So you've got no guarantee if you leave.
No.
If you leave the Eurozone, that you'll be able to get back in without complications.
I think pretty strongly that I wouldn't. Is the current situation, and the window opened, I believe, the 14th of April to apply for the amnesty, and closes soon on the 30th of June. And by all accounts, there have been a million applicants for half the number of spaces. And how is Spain going to process these applications and allocate those 500,000 places? I have no idea. And when will they do that?
Huh? Did you not think that they might? It's a bit like Trump and the Straits of Hormuz, isn't it? You sort of start something and process, and then this happens, and you think, did you not think that might happen? I mean, I'm surprised there are only a million applicants. To be honest with you, I'd have thought there might
true.
Be there
well,
might
actually,
be 2 million.
That's statistics from my father about a week ago that read some article in England. So it might not actually be that accurate. There might be more. But my advisor that's kind of helped me with the process said that with all the other advisors she knows throughout Spain doing the same job, not one person has got a positive response, a negative response, accepted, rejected across the whole country. So,
right. So you're going through an advisor or through a gestor?
I did, just because I'm like fiercely independent, but and I've did all the application myself before. However, I just get to the point where you think, well, I just need to do it properly.
Yeah.
And have a bit of top cover.
Yeah, no, I entrust it to a professional. I got my TIR card through, I mean, I jumped through hoops, but the actual process was done by a professional, and thank God for that. Oh, right, okay, so I was going to say a rock and a hard place, but it's not that really. It's kind of like you're floating.
It is a
not
bit.
Quite sure where you're going to land.
Yeah, we've mentioned it before. Like, if you know the plan and it's not great, okay, well, we can deal with it. We know the plan, but it's just sitting in uncertainty. And I've got like quite important job in the UK actually for a couple of weeks in September, and it's coming by a bit quick, and I just don't know how to attack that situation.
And there's no one you can talk to. There's no one you can talk to in the actual immigration department. He said, jokingly.
I think they're all maxed out dealing with it. I mean, yeah. I don't think anyone knows any answers. And actually, I was sort of trying to calculate the other day, even if I did get lucky enough to get one of those places, what does it then mean to be able to travel? Does it then mean you need to book a TIE an appointment to get some specific bit of paper? Or is the fact that you've got some sort of green light for one of these places, can you travel the next day, I wonder?
Yeah, and I wonder if anybody has had a successful application for amnesty granted. Do we know that?
No, apparently not. That's what I was saying.
Nobody's had one. Right.
Not one person has had one accepted or rejected.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have an advanced case of constipation.
On that
bombshell, we're going to have to leave it. Thank you very much for your time, Kate Sermon, and the very best of luck.
Thank you, Kit.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
That's Kate Sermon there with applying for amnesty. And I wonder if you're in or know of anybody in a similar boat and if anybody's been successful yet. That is all we've got time for. Thank you so much for your company. Thank you to Giles Brown, our resident historian, to Coy Lopez-Hogg for his insight into the world of professional sport, and to Kate Sermon, who is waiting for her amnesty to be able to stay here in Spain. The best of luck to her. The best of luck to you. Have a lovely weekend. Bye-bye for now.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.